Coming up, Rich Little joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. It is the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. Hello. Thank you for listening. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Bird.
Hi, everybody.
We are very excited
because we're so excited.
We're going to be talking to Rich Little. We're really excited about this. So much a part of all of our, childhoods and growing up and all the celebrity roasts and Johnny Carson and all of that. So,
and the game shows.
Yes.
And stuff.
And the crazy clothes and the big ties and the bell bottoms. I've been having really fun, a lot of fun doing all the research.
Massive nostalgia hits, I would imagine, right?
Yes. Well, for me, I mean, and I became obsessed with the show that he did, which we're going to ask about, called Copycats. Mm-hmm. Surreal, you know, that there was a time with variety shows where, you know, really famous actors would just come on and be in sketches.
Yes.
And I was just thinking, like, wouldn't it be awesome to have a variety show and, you know, Russell Crowe comes on and does, I mean, I suppose SNL is like that a little bit.
A little.
But that's more, I guess they have some sketches, but the variety show sketches were primarily movie sketches.
Right.
That's what kind of always made them funny. So if Raymond Burr was on, they'd do a Perry Mason ripoff, or if John Wayne was on, they'd do like a cowboy.
Right.
You know, kind of a take. Now, do you do any impressions?
Golly, you're terrible.
Do you do any? I don't.
I can do, you know, I could do a British accent on occasion.
No, I know.
You suck. I've been out of that game for a really long time.
I know, I threw it at you.
Well,
it's horrible because, again, I haven't tried. I should have, in preparation for knowing we were going to do Rich Little, I can sort of, kind of, when I have a cold, do some Carol Channing. Some raspberries for Carol Channing. Oh, it's marvelous. That's marvelous. Or do I sound like an old black man in Harlem? I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I have a friend who was on Broadway with her, and he does a hilarious Carol Channing with the eyebrows. He like mimics the eyebrows with his finger. It's hilarious.
My aside from Rich Little, of course, doing so many, I want to have him do his James Mason. I have all my favorites that I want to do. I love Mario Cantone doing Liza Minnelli, Judy Garland.
Yes.
He knows this. One time I sent him because I carry with me the DVD Laugh Whore, which he is in. It's a wonderful one-man show that he did. Mm-hmm. And I think he thought I was making it up, so I took a picture of it and I sent it to him. I mean, it's an older show, but man, I love that. I love me some good Liza Minnelli every once in a while.
Oh yeah,
like a good impression is spot on and fun. Yeah. And of course, Kevin Pollak does so many great.
Who has been on the podcast with us? Also, Mary Birdsong.
That's right.
She does a Judy Garland.
That's right.
Or Liza Minnelli, or both. I'm not sure.
She does both. Yeah. But so this is going to be fun because it's going to reboot all the people out there doing impressions. And that's one of the things I want to ask him, is that what is it with about current people? Do they not have enough personality to be imitated?
Right.
You know, is there something wrong with their cadence?
Right. Well, you know, one of the things I think it might be is that people are so visible in their real lives these days, you know, because of social media.
Right.
That, you know, in order to create a caricature, whether it's, you know, a live version or a picture version of it,
yes,
you have to exaggerate certain qualities. Right. And for me, I think that's easier to do when you only see snippets of someone.
Right.
So you can really like grasp little bits. Mm-hmm. And people are so available to us kind of 24/7 in their real lives, it's a little hard to find the things to exaggerate. Does that make sense?
It does. Also, nobody has a catchphrase, you know, like Betty Davis with her "what a dump" or, you know, a Pilgrim, John Wayne. You need a good catchphrase. Yeah. Pick me up. I've fallen and I can't get up. I think that'll be
Yeah, they all come from commercials anymore. I know. Where's the beef?
And I don't think he does we're going to get to copycats. There's probably three other people out there that are screaming about copycats because it was this incredibly cool show with every impressionist that was Fred Travellina.
Was this a game show kind of a thing or no?
No, this was they shot it in London. We'll ask them all about it. But again, where they did sketches involving, you know, famous films and things like that. And it seemed like it would be really fun. And I would, you know, I wish they could do something like that. But again, somehow we don't all have the same movie, you know, references.
Right. That's right.
But I think it's amazing too, just to have a career, you know, he's working at the Laugh Factory in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. That's where we're all going to end up in Vegas, right? That's where
probably
that's where all the performers go. Okay. Well, we should get this thing started.
I'm so excited
to bring on Rich Little.
We're calling him via Skype. I don't know if everybody knew that. But
that's right.
Because he's in Vegas, we've got him via Skype.
Yes, apologies. He's working. He's in show business.
That's right.
He's waiting for us patiently. How exciting. All righty. Rich Little, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to hear your intro. Known for his vast repertoire of celebrity impressions and voices, he began working on his craft while working as an usher. We're going to get to that in a movie house in Canada. He has studied voices of stars his whole life and was once named, well, I'm still going to call you the greatest impressionist in the world, and on many television shows, including The Flying Nun, Petticoat Junction, All in the Family, Love American Style, The Nanny, Futurama, Better Off Dead. Oh, we got to get to Copycat, The Late Shift, and so many, many, many more. Please welcome Rich Little. Thank you so much. That was a very long introduction.
I know it was.
You get to talk now, finally, Rich.
Hi, Rich.
Well, I think the greatest impressionist of all time was Vincent Van Gogh. Vincent Van Gogh was the greatest impression.
Oh, I see.
Vincent Van Gogh.
That was a good one right off the bat. Now, I know you grew up in Canada, and you said you worked as a movie usher. Do you happen to – we always ask people if they remember the first film that they saw. Do you remember the first film you saw?
First film I ever saw. Hello Again, I think, was the first one.
Hello Again. Who was in that?
I don't know. I don't know who was in that. What happened to her?
And
the lady in the park, wasn't she?
Oh, I think you're kidding me. You're kidding me. That was, yes, that may have been, you know, that was my accidental start in show business. Mm.
Yes, the lady in the park, yes.
That was
on great things after that, I'll tell you. So the first movie the first adult movie I ever remember seeing with my father was A Christmas Carol with Alistair Sim.
Uh-huh. Wow.
1950. And that movie had such an effect on me that I took the story, which is a marvelous story, you know, of A Christmas Carol, and I did it as an album. I did it as a TV show, which won an Emmy. And I did it as a stage play, too.
Wow.
Yeah,
so that was really inspiring to you. Incredibly inspiring, obviously.
It's a great movie. They've made it a number of times, A Christmas Carol, but the Alistair Sim one was still the best. Still the best.
You released it as an album. Can people still get that album?
Oh, yeah, I think you can find it. I don't know whether there's a hole in the middle of it or not. A lot of people don't know what an album is, you know?
Right.
Well, but
you could probably find it somewhere.
There's
always people coming up to me when I do my signing after my show at the Tropicana, giving me old records and pictures I don't even remember.
Is that fun or is it daunting?
Sometimes they remember things I have no recollection of at all. And it's funny. They know your career better than you do, you know?
Well, that's what's so amazing about YouTube is
somebody said to me, you come from Ottawa? And I said, yeah. And you went to Glebe Collegiate, right? And I said, no, I did not go to Glebe Collegiate. Yes, you did. They're funny. And I had a kid not too long, about 15, sitting in the front row.
Uh-huh.
I thought to myself, he doesn't know anybody I'm imitating.
Uh-huh.
He was laughing through the whole show. He was in hysterics. So when the show was over, I asked him, I said, you seem to enjoy the show. And he said, I did. You're very, very funny. But I was confused. I said, you were confused about what? He said, I was just wondering why you kept changing your voice.
Oh. Okay.
Now, when... What possessed you to be? Did you always love movies? Like you were a movie usher. Was that accidental, or did you love movies? Like when you were a kid?
Terrible movie usher, because I was always watching the screen and people screaming and stumbling. I saw Marty, the movie Marty, about 32 times, and when I met Ernest Borgnine for the first time, I started doing all the dialogue.
Wow!
And he looked at me and he said, I don't even remember any of that. How do you remember that? I said, because I watched the movie 32 times. Right. I was a terrible usher. Terrible. I saw a movie called Interrupted Melody with Glenn Ford and Eleanor Parker. And because I'd seen it so many times as an usher, I counted microphones in the picture about 12 times.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Which you'd never notice the first time.
And what did your bosses think of this? Did they think it was funny, or did you get in trouble?
I got fired eventually.
Yeah, how long did you work as an usher? Do you remember?
With bruises, you know, they couldn't cut their seats. And I finally got fired. I only did that for a short time. But I've always loved movies. I mean, that's how I started doing impressions.
Yeah.
No, actually, I started doing impressions imitating teachers.
Uh-huh.
That's how I started. And I knew this was going to be my lifetime work, because it wasn't long before the teachers were charging a 2-drink minimum and a cover charge. Yep.
But when you were a kid, well, I know you did think before you became a professional sort of impressionist, you were a disc jockey. But how did you think you could make money doing impressions? Did you think you could make money?
I didn't at the beginning. It was just a hobby. I never thought anybody would pay me for doing this. You know, I was doing teachers and local politicians, a few movie stars, but I never thought of it as a lifetime work. You know, even my parents didn't, you know, they got to forget about doing these impressions and concentrate on a career, you know?
Right.
And, I suddenly realized that people kind of liked it, you know, when you impersonated them, and that was potential in it, and that's when I started taking it seriously.
Uh-huh.
Actually, when I got paid for the first time is when I took it seriously, really.
Who paid you for the first time?
I did a couple of shows, actually, with Paul Anka back in those early days.
Wow.
Paul from Ottawa. And I did shows for the, the Shriners and Columbus, and they would pay me $10 or $15, and I would go out and do, I don't know, 10 or 20 minutes. And as I said, I was doing local politicians and a few movie stars. But when I started to get paid for it, I thought, wow, maybe there's something in this. You know?
So in those early days, would the people hiring you give you requests? I mean, would they ask you to do specific people?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I did the Prime Minister of Canada, and I did the Mayor of Ottawa, and... was imitating all kinds of people, but until I got to the States, when I came down to do the Judy Garland show in 1964, that changed everything for me, because now I was into the big time.
Yeah.
And to think that I would do the Judy Garland show as my first show in the U.S., that was a big, big step for me. And she was very, very nice to me. Very.
So doing the Judy Garland show, it's like, where do you begin? What was the experience? I mean, just to be there and be backstage, and working with Judy Garland.
I have done a television show in Toronto with Mel Torme, the singer mm-hmm. Mel Torme. Mel and I were great friends. And I had Mel put all my voices on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was going to work for Judy Garland on her television show, doing special musical material for her. And he played Judy Garland this tape that I had done with about 30 or 40 of my impressions on it.
Uh-huh.
And she wasn't impressed. She didn't like impersonators. And he kept saying, oh, you got to hear this one. You got to hear this one. No, she was not impressed until I did James Mason.
Oh.
So as I started to do my James Mason from a start. I was doing my James Mason. Everything changed after that. And that's how I got on the Judy Garland show, because of James Mason. And I ran into James Mason about 2 months after doing the Garland show. And I went up to him and thanked him for getting me on the Judy Garland show. And he looked at me and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, I imitate you. And he said, what on earth for?
Oh my God, that's funny.
That's great.
Now, does it ever, I mean, I was just about to, you know, say, do James Mason and Lolita, but does it ever get irritating for people like me or just to keep asking you, like, as if you're a candy machine to keep doing?
I used to do a speech from A Star Is Born.
Uh-huh.
Listen to me, Esther. A career is a curious thing. You know, not only have you got talent, but you're good with them. You've got that certain something that becomes a star.
I'm in heaven.
I love it. Rich, how does your process work of, you know, first of all, deciding what characters to do and then, you know, figuring out how to transform your voice into that?
Well, you know, you've got to pick people that are well known, you know. I do a lot of character actors and voices I like to do privately. But when you on stage, you've got to do the well-known ones, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, as a matter of fact, I started sketching before I did impressions,
mm-hmm.
doing portraits. And I think because these people were in my head and I could not only imitate them, I could draw them, you know.
Right.
And I've done hundreds of sketches down through the years.
Uh-huh. There,
you know, people like Jimmy Stewart.
And, wow.
And this
Dean is your work you're showing us right now?
And
those are great.
Wow, those are beautiful.
Make my bidet. Anyway, I put a lot of my sketches and my book. I've got a brand new book out.
Uh-huh. Yes, you do.
Hold it up so we can, because
it's called The People I Have Known and Been.
Uh-huh.
Little by Little.
Oh, I love it.
And what's it about? It's about 30 pages, actually. No, it's funny things that have happened with me and celebrities down through the years. And I've been so fortunate in my career to have worked with some of the greatest. I mean, not only comedians, but actors, especially on the Dean Martin roast.
I know, we're getting to that. Just, I was like, just tell us everything.
Well, you know, I was very privileged to be on the Dean Martin roast because I was only in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
I was working with all my idols, all the people that I grew up with, like Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne and George Burns and Jack Benny and Don Rickles and Dean himself, and it was just a terrific, terrific thrill for me to be with such company.
Right.
But it was terrifying at the same time, because here am I, this kid from Ottawa, you know, not very experienced, working with these giants.
Yeah.
And, boy, I'm telling you, you had to pull yourself together to do that, because just looking down at the dais and seeing all these faces, Orson Welles and Lucille Ball and, it was terrifying, but somehow I pulled it together and I did 24 Dean Martin roasts.
Did you ever get any notes from the great, you know, Milton Berle, Jack Benny? Did they ever say, pull you aside and say, kid, you should be doing this or that? Or were they just good audiences?
Well, Milton used to pull me aside occasionally and say, kid, don't get too funny. No, they were always very helpful, very, very helpful. I had a lot of help in those days. Uh-huh. You know, the writers would write for you on the roast.
Uh-huh.
They would write material for you. And what you do is you take out the things that you liked, that you were comfortable with, and then you may change a few things, add a few jokes of your own. But mainly I did my own material.
Right.
Yeah.
Did
Dean was an interesting guy because Dean really just waltzed through life without a care in the world. Dean, I remember one time we were doing a roast and we were walking to the dais about a minute from taping, and Dean looked over at me and said, "Rich, who are we honoring tonight? who's the guest of honor?" I said, "Michael Landon." Oh, that's a good choice. Yeah, we're going to have some fun, yeah. I didn't know who we were honoring. I mean, can you imagine doing a show and not knowing who you're honoring and not looking at the cue cards? And he didn't seem to care. You know, he said, "I'll find out when I see the name on the cards."
Amazing.
He wanted it to be fresh.
Now, to me at home, to the kids, I mean, it always looked like everybody was having a lot to drink. Is that true, or was that just a perception that Dean Martin wanted?
No, he didn't drink that much. He spilled most of it, actually. He actually, you know, out of Dean and Frank and Sammy, I would say Dean drank the less.
Uh-huh.
Of those three.
Yeah.
Sammy was a pretty big drinker, and so was Sinatra. There's no question of that.
You know? Yeah.
Even on stage, Frank drank, you know?
Yeah.
Dean was usually drinking apple juice. I only saw Dean really snockered at the Reagan inauguration gala in 1981, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
It was the only time when Frank banned him from the show. He told him to go back to the hotel and he got really upset. But he was sloshed.
Uh-huh.
And the only time I ever saw Dean drunk was at that function.
Wow. What happens when the roast is over? Do people continue to party, or what happens? Just paint me a picture.
The fun part was in the green room before we did the roast, because in the green room we're all socializing and drinking coffee and having sandwiches.
Yeah.
And everybody's talking to everybody, and that was great fun. And that went on for about half an hour. And then Dean would stick his head in and go, "How are you doing, Pally?" And then that was it.
Wow.
But that was a very social time before the roast.
Right.
After the roast was over, everybody went on their merry way, you know?
And
you didn't see them until the next time you did a roast. Most of those roasts were done at the MGM Grand in Vegas.
Amazing.
Oh, okay.
It's so funny the way that, you know, again, my perception of comedians and impressionists growing up is, you know, you'd see everybody on the Ed Sullivan Show and they'd always be wearing a tuxedo. And like, do you remember a transition where things I started to get relaxed? I personally can't stand this idea of comedians that wear t-shirts and jeans. I used to love the idea of the comedian in a tuxedo, but I was wondering if you had any thought about that, or if it's just
the days of Las Vegas, we all wore a tuxedo.
I know, I love that.
And the audience were in suits and the women in fancy dresses, but now you'll see people in the show in tank tops.
I know,
right?
And all they care about is filling up the room. They don't care what they look like anymore. But there's no class anymore.
Really. Yeah,
it's amazing.
So some other stars that you did, of course, you know, one of my favorites was, of course, Johnny Carson. And, do you find it all, like, again, do you have conversations with, there is no more Johnny Carson to go on and
that's right. Johnny Carson. Did you hear that thieves broke into the police department here this morning in Las Vegas? And they stole all their toilet seats. Did you know this? So far, the police have nothing to go on. That's the kind of joke that Johnny liked.
Yeah.
Kind of, funny and funny, but
yeah.
Corny. And Reagan did too. Reagan loved corny jokes.
Uh huh.
When I used to go to the White House, which I did quite a bit when Reagan was president, he would always want me to give him a couple of jokes.
Wow.
And the cornier they were, the better.
Uh huh.
He had a wonderful sense of humor, Reagan does. Reagan one time said to me, he said, "You know, Rich, I think you do me better than I do. As a matter of fact, you do me so well that I was thinking when I pass away, they should bury you."
Oh, my God.
That's a funny joke.
Did a wonderful sense of humor, Reagan did.
Did either of them ever ask you to do prank phone calls or call anyone and pretend that they were them?
No, I have done that, though, occasionally over the years.
Yeah.
I remember I couldn't get on an airline flight to – I was going to Chicago one time, and I had to get there for a gig, and they were booked up. So yeah. I phoned up as Cary Grant.
Oh.
Listen, I have to get to Chicago on Friday, and I was hoping there would be a reservation for them.
They said,
Mr. Penn, of course there is. Oh, wonderful. That's great. Listen, Rich Little will be picking up my ticket.
Perfect.
Oh, man.
One time I was at a blood bank years ago. This is funny. I was in a blood bank, and behind the curtain, the doctors were taking blood. And when I got behind the curtain with the doctor, I started to do Kermit the Frog.
Uh-huh.
I yelled out, "Help! Help! I am a frog. I don't give blood. Help! Help! I'm being murdered. They want my legs."
They want my legs.
Oh, my God. The other person I have to ask you about, I mean, again, nobody does Richard Nixon anymore, but for a time there, again, I mean, that just must have been a full-time industry, right?
Oh, yeah, I did Nixon so much.
I know.
My own parents tried to have me impeached. My nose kept growing, and I kept telling lies all the time.
How did he feel about his impression?
Nixon would say,
God,
looking at Hillary Clinton's emails, I'm starting to look pretty good.
What our current politicians are as they as easy to do or not? It's somehow current politicians don't seem as funny as Richard Nixon.
No.
I mean, he seems like a cartoon character.
Oh, yeah, he was a cartoon character. No question about it.
Well, I think I'm
having a little fun with Donald Trump, it's not a great voice to do. We're going to build a wall, a great wall, and Walmart is going to pay for the wall, or Walgreens or Mark Wahlberg. They're going to build a great wall.
What is the, I suddenly was thinking, everybody laughs at Richard Nixon, but suddenly when you go into Donald Trump, it's like I froze up, like, is it funny or is it harder to do somebody like Donald Trump?
Well, he's not as distinctive as a Nixon is. Jimmy Carter was fun to do because he had that little soft voice of his.
Yeah.
Pop down, good to be here. Jimmy Carter. And George Bush Senior, had that way of speaking where he punctuated words.
Yeah.
The other day, this was about 20 years ago, I joined the parachute club in Houston, and I paid them cash. I came home and I said to Barr, I've joined the parachute club. Here's the receipt. She said, "Did you look at this?" I said, no, didn't look at it. What? "You joined the prostitute club." I signed up for 12 jumps.
Whoops.
Now, Rich, do you imitate people in your own personal life, or is it just celebrities? Like, do you ever bother
No. I do neighbors, and I used to imitate my mother.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I could do my father, and people that nobody knew, but my mother had a great voice, And she, I remember I would phone her after doing the Sullivan Show, and I'd say, Mother, what did you think?
I didn't like the tie. Khaki suit has got to go. I didn't like it, but the shoes were okay. What did you think of my performance, Mother? I didn't notice.
So take me back to when you were on the Ed Sullivan Show. Like, who else was on the bill? What was Ed like? I mean, tell me everything. I can't. This is the Ed Sullivan Theater, right? That
Ed was the only man I ever met in my life who could count up to three and get two of the numbers wrong. He was one sandwich short of a picnic. Let me tell you. You know, the wheel was spinning, but the rodent was dead.
Okay.
He was a strange man. He never smiled. Uh-huh. And he did not like people impersonating him. You know that?
No.
People did. My God. A lot of people did, Ed. So he never liked it, but he used to fake it.
Right.
He knew that people were looking at him, and if he didn't have a sense of humor, he was a stuffed shirt. So he would fake it, but he never liked it when anybody impersonated him at all.
Uh-huh.
But he put up with it. He was a strange man. He was always looking at the cue cards.
Uh-huh.
He had cue cards for everything. I think he took the cue card guy home with him at night to talk to his wife, you know. And he was always looking over your shoulder like he was reading a cue card, even if you said hello to him.
Right.
So the last time I ever saw him, he was about 75 years old, and he was going across Fifth Avenue in New York, and I stopped and said, "Hello, Mr. Sullivan. You probably don't remember me, Rich Little." And he looked around, and he looked over my shoulder, and he said, "Don't walk."
Oh, God. Now, who else would be on the bill with you when you were on Ed Sullivan?
You know, there were a lot of people, regulars, like Mr. Pastry, Richard Stern was his name, I think, something like that. And then Wayne and Schuster were on. Uh-huh. There was comics from Canada. They were on a lot. Alan Rossi, they were on a lot. And Robert Goulet. And I mean, there were so many. And we used to change in these tacky little dressing rooms.
Uh-huh.
So with a rickety old elevator. And it would take you about 10 minutes to get up there. And they had a rope ladder out the window. And it was amazing. I remember one time I was changing in a room with an orangutan. Because they had nowhere to put this orangutan, and they chained it to
a radiator or something.
This orangutan, I'm trying to change in a corner. I was terrified. And when the show was over, Ed was rapping on doors, going, "Robert, wonderful performance tonight, really sensational." And then another rap on a door, and you'd hear, "Barbara Streisand, you were absolutely magnificent." And then he came into my room and he said, "You were sensational. I've never seen anything as great as that tonight." I said, "Thank you, Ed." He said, no, I was talking to the orangutan.
Oh, my God.
Maybe he should go talk to your mom next.
Do you ever watch any, like, you know, I was saying we could all watch these things on YouTube. I got sucked into watching, you know, 18 copycats. Do you go back and watch them yourself, or?
Well, I do, but, you know, I'm like everybody, every actor and actress, I'm sure yourself too. When you look at yourself in the past, you think, "Oh, I could have done that better." Yeah. "Oh, that wasn't very good." And then everybody's saying, "Oh, no, that was great. You were wonderful."
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not a good judge, but, you know, because I'm my worst critic. But I kind of look at stuff from the past. But, you know, I'm not too thrilled about it because I always think I could have done better.
So I want to get to Copycats because, again, it's just this really cool underground show. How did that concept come about?
I don't know how that concept came about. It was filmed in England.
Uh-huh.
We had a bunch of impersonators, and Frank Gorshin. And,
yeah, it's crazy.
George Kirby and Evelina and Marilyn Michaels and all these wonderful people. And then they brought guest stars over every week. And we got a lot of great stars to do it because they got to do impressions.
Yeah.
And a lot of them really enjoyed that. You know, to hear Robert Young, you know, do his impression of Bela Lugosi was kind of funny.
Oh, it's great.
Oh, my
gosh.
Raymond Burr. Oh. You know, we had Raymond Burr on and Debbie Reynolds and Tony Curtis was on and some wonderful people. Mm-hmm. It was a great show. Fabulous.
Did you have any we'd mentioned some of the people that I was actually watching. Any favorite highlights? Why did they shoot it in England?
I don't know why they shot it. Well, probably because the concept was invented in England.
Oh, mm-hmm. I see.
We decided to do this show, and they thought, well, we'll do it at Elstree, which, is outside of London.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they did it. I think they did a couple, though, in New York early that I was on. And then we did about 8 or 12 in England. And they were great fun. Orson Welles was on.
Yeah.
He was terrific.
Yeah, the Orson Welles one is particularly funny. Anything, he was a famous director, obviously. Anything he ever give you, no, he seems like an intimidating.
Yeah.
I never met Orson Welles. Of course, I was off him, and I remember all
Yeah.
Movies. And I remember I was filming a bit, Famous Stars Sneezing.
Oh, God.
And I was doing these various sneezes of people, you know, like Cary Grant sneezing. And Louis Armstrong sneezing. And I was doing all these people sneezing, and then Orson Welles came in, and I never met him before, and he was standing at the back.
Uh-huh.
Said Orson Welles sneezing, and he walked right on camera, put his hand on my shoulder, and said, "I never sneeze." Fucked off.
Oh my
and they
God.
Left that in the show.
Oh, man. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I
never sneeze.
Ever.
I love about all these stories that you're telling is that nothing relies on punchline. You know, it's all sort of relatable. Like you just said that, Famous Star Sneezing. What a great, funny
premise.
Concept
yeah.
that is.
Yeah, I used to do some crazy concepts like, the animals of favorite famous stars, what they would sound like.
Okay. Shoot.
You know, you know, like Kirk Douglas's parrot. Squawk, squawk. Fox Tiger's dog. Bark, bark, bark. You are nothing. You understand me? On the paper. You are nothing. Bark, bark, bark. Growl, growl, growl.
Oh, my God.
Jimmy Stewart's dog. Why?
Oh my God! Do this all day. Now, when you were with all these other impressionists together in a room having lunch or whatever, did you compare notes or was everybody quiet?
No, everybody got along pretty good. You know, sometimes there was a little friction when they give somebody a voice to do that somebody else could do it better.
Mm. Right.
You had to sort of bite your lip and say, oh, okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah.
It was interesting because the two writers on the show, their names were Peppiot and Aylesworth, were great friends of mine, and they started my career. And they were writers on Copycats, and they knew every voice I did, and they put down on a blackboard all my voices. There were 60-some voices that they wrote down. And then Charlie Callis had his name, and it said Georgie Jessel under it. That's all it said.
No.
But it was interesting because even Frank Gorshin, there was about 10 or 12. But I had a lot of voices. So
yeah.
I was playing on that show because I could do a lot of different parts and play a lot of different people. And that was a wonderful show, but I never see it. I don't think it's in syndication at all.
It's on, you can watch it.
You can find it on YouTube.
You can find
it
on YouTube. It's so fun. I was watching it.
Okay.
In anticipation.
I'll put some of the links on our website, on your page on our website, so people can look at those.
I had on a TV show. I was doing the Julie Andrews show.
Yeah, tell us about that.
That was the most fun for me because Alice Ghostly, who was a wonderful comedian,
mm-hmm.
did all the comedy on that show because Julie usually sang. She did a lot of comedy, but mostly sang. And I got to do a lot of characters. And these two writers, Pepe and Nailsworth, were writing that show too. So I did a lot of sketches and a lot of things with Julie and with a lot of great stars. And that was a wonderful time for me to do the Julie Andrews show.
How many?
It was wonderful.
How many years was that on? Or
I think it was only on for one or two seasons. Uh-huh. I think it didn't last too long, you know. Which is a shame, really, because it was a great show.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, big productions.
Was she with Blake Edwards during that time?
Yeah, it's funny. Blake Edwards would show up on the set and say nothing. He was smart. He might have said something in the dressing room to her.
Right. Maybe
privately to the producer or director. But he didn't interfere at all. He just sort of watched from the wings.
Uh-huh.
And he's a very quiet kind of a guy, and I never really got to talk to him, but what a genius he was. Wow.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, especially his work with Peter Sellers, you know, all the Clouseau. Did you ever?
Yeah. I dubbed for Peter Sellers after he passed away, and I did David Niven, too, for a couple of Pink Panther movies.
God, what?
I've done that over the years, dubbed for stars that have either passed away or had laryngitis or...
Right.
And I did Tony Curtis once for a movie that he walked off on.
What's the movie? What movie?
Oh, it was a terrible epic filmed in Italy, and he didn't get paid, and he left. And he just walked out. There was no ending. So they got somebody to play him in a long shot of him riding over a bridge or something. And then they wanted me to dub his voice so they could finish the movie.
Wow.
I phoned Tony and I said, "Is this okay?" And he said, "Well, Rich, are they paying you? Are you getting paid?" And I said, "Yeah. Well, get your money up front. Otherwise, these bastards will leave you cold." So I said, "Well, yeah, they are paying me up front. Okay, Richie, you can do it. And listen, send me half the check."
Did you?
No. Yeah, why?
Good.
I remember that now that you say that with the Peter Sellers movie, I kind of remember that.
I did Gene Kelly for a Christmas special. He had lost his voice completely.
Oh, wow.
And that was fun to do because I loved to imitate. No, Gene Kelly had that kind of a whispery kind of a voice. And he talked up here like this, you know.
Yeah.
I did the whole thing, you know, about Christmas movies and great movies that have a Christmas theme to them. And I did that as Gene Kelly, and I never told anybody, and nobody ever knew I did that. And,
wow. And
if you watch it, you really can't tell. Really can't tell.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
That's amazing. Well, I know you also do a great Humphrey Bogart in The Caine Mutiny.
Yeah.
That's another really, do you do that one in your show?
I guess I do. All the gin joints and all the towns and all the world. I had to walk into the Tropicana. That's where I'm performing four nights a week for Tropicana here in Vegas.
Nice. And you're doing that for several more months, right?
What?
Several more months that you're going to be there.
Well, I've been there now for nearly 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's time I went home. But it's great because I only do an hour, and I show film clip. What I do is I do the impression of like George Burns, and then I show me with George Burns.
Oh, that's great.
Cool.
John Wayne, I show me with John Wayne.
Right.
With Dean Martin, with Frank Sinatra. So that's what I do in the show. I do the impression and then show me with them. So it gives me credibility when I do it.
So we were talking at the beginning of the show about why is it that the current stars, I mean, past Clint Eastwood, I guess, are there any modern stars that really have distinct voices that you can copy or personas? Is it more challenging?
Oh, it is. It gets tougher and tougher because we just don't have voices anymore. We have good actors, but
right,
we just don't have voices anymore. You know what I was thinking the other day after watching the Academy Awards? that back in the 40s, all these beautiful women made love to Cary Grant and Clark Gable and Robert Taylor. And today, they make love to a fish. And we've come a long way, haven't we? Did you see the movie? The
I did, I did, I did. I believe that was the original title.
The guy that played the fish, the makeup was incredible.
It was.
He didn't get paid much, you know. He just got scale.
Oh.
But I mean, it won the Academy Award, but I have no idea why. As soon as I saw the scene where she gets in the bathtub with the fish, that did it for me. That was it.
You were done?
I don't know how you make love to a fish.
I don't think I want to know.
No, I don't either. Well, at least they didn't show that. So. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite film, a classic film of yours? That I mean, I know you mentioned Christmas Carol. Are there other films?
There's a couple of movies that I think my favorite movie of all time is probably The Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah, that's a great film. Great.
Fred McMurtry and Dana Andrews and Teresa. What was her name?
Teresa Wright.
Teresa Wright. Yes. And it's just a marvel. It moves me every time I see it. I like that, of course. I like Casablanca. I like Micah. I like a movie. Did you ever see a movie with Albert Finney called The Dresser?
Oh
yeah.
Incredible film.
Oh, I could watch that movie over and over and over. I think it's a classic movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I like movies like that. But I don't know about making love to a fish. But anyway, Gone with the Wind, of course, I love that movie. But, you know, there's a lot of movies that I like.
Do you do Dana Andrews? I've never heard a good Dana Andrews impression. I love Dana Andrews.
Dana Andrews, you can torture us, Colonel. You can pull out my fingernails. You can make me count up to three. But I will never disclose what the American people.
Do you have favorite characters that you do that just sort of trip off your tongue and are the most enjoyable?
Oh yeah. I love to do Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
I love to do Reagan, of course, and Jimmy Stewart. You know, Jimmy was the first voice I ever did.
Wow!
And I remember seeing a movie called The Far Country, and Jimmy, his horse's name was Pie. And I remember coming home and sitting down at the dinner table, and I said to my mom, "Mom, I'd like a piece of apple pie." That was it. That's how I started to do Jimmy Stewart. And isn't that interesting? His horse's name was Pie. You know, Jimmy once said to me, he said, "Rich, I wish I'd known you back in the 40s. You could have done a lot of my dubbing for me. Uh-huh. I could have made a lot more movies, you know. But Jimmy was great. As he got older, of course, he got a little slower. But
yeah.
I remember one time at some event he said, "You know, Glory and I, well, not Glory, I like Rich so much, I actually thought of adopting him." I really did. I thought about it, but when I mentioned it to Gloria, she said, no, Jim, no, two people around the house going, whoa, would be one too many.
What about it when you were, I remember one time being in Los Angeles, it was like one of the most exciting nights of my life. I went to, it no longer exists now, Chasen's.
Mm.
And it was everything I wanted it to be. You know, like at every table, Jack Lemmon, you know, Kirk Douglas, Gregory Peck. Did you have nights like that where you'd walk around and just have fun and they'd say, "Do Jimmy for us"?
No, I actually had dinner with Jimmy and Gloria at Chasen's one night. And Alfred Hitchcock was sitting right next to him.
Wow.
And before I even knew he was there, I heard somebody say, "Would you please pass the man?" And it was Alfred Hitchcock.
Amazing.
But you're right. That place was loaded with celebrities.
Oh, my God. It was that tail end of what it probably was. I mean, I can't even imagine, but it was like that little bit of glamour.
Yeah.
Just to see movie stars.
Yeah. Yeah.
My last question for you. Thank you so much for doing this, because I know you've done some acting and you were in The Late Shift. Did you ever think about going the route, like, you know, Hal Holbrook, where you play one character? Or,
well, I did Jimmy Stewart, The Life of Jimmy Stewart, for 2 years at the Hilton in Vegas.
Uh-huh.
I hoped to take it to Broadway. Almost made it, but we didn't come through with the money.
Oh, I see.
For a couple of years, and it was Jimmy's whole life story.
Wow.
And the great thing about that was that Jimmy worked with so many great actors that I could put them in the show.
Right.
And so I got to do people that worked with Jimmy, like George C. Scott and Henry Fonda and Alfred Hitchcock and all these people, Jack Lemmon, and all these people were in it. And So that was great. I wish that I'd done more with that show, but it didn't quite make it. But I had fun doing it. I really did.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Well, I that sounds like a wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm.
Keep trying.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, Rich, thank you so much for doing this. It's really been such an honor and a thrill, and you made me laugh for an hour.
Absolutely. Rich, I've got it for you right here. Look for Rich live in Las Vegas at the Laugh Factory in the Tropicana, and you can buy his book, Little by Little, on his website, richlittle.com. Thank you, Rich. You can also buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, now out in bookstores and on Amazon. Also, check out our Facebook page, and our website is ileanaspodcast.com.
Yes.
Ileana, I love your work too. I know you very well.
Oh, I would imagine being roasted.
I'd never be lonely.
Rich, this has been such a delight. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Oh, we're waving. Goodbye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.